So we as organizers of this program were happily thinking there would be no Monday lunch since the director was out of town, but then at the end of last week we were told there would be. And so the result is that the four of us are going to be talking. And I think in some ways that this is illustrative of the cooperative spirit that there is in this field. It is the marriage of, or comes from the marriage of two traditions in some sense, some people coming from the condensed matter community and melded with people coming from atomic physics and related areas. And this, I think, has contributed a lot to the vitality of the field. And in addition, as one will hear later on, there's a lot of input coming from, or interaction from, people with backgrounds in nuclear physics, quantum optics, and well, people interested in general non-linear phenomena. And I thought that what I'd do is just try and explain a little about where the field came from historically. And rather than going back one whole century and give you the whole history of superfluidity, superconductivity, I think I go back to the 50s, when there was a very important paper by Oliver Penrose and Lars Onsager, where they made the first real quantitative estimate of what the fraction of condensed particles was in liquid helium. So as one knows, in a Bose gas at zero temperature, one would expect all the particles to be in the lowest energy state, the zero momentum state, if I had just a box. But in liquid helium, the effects of the condensate are to a large extent disguised by the effects of interactions. And Onsager and Penrose and Onsager made the first estimate of the condensate fraction, and they came to the conclusion that N naught over N was something of order, or as I recall, 8% at zero pressure. And basically, because this number, and this turns out to be a very good estimate, despite the rather simple wave function they employed at the time. And during the 50s, lots of calculations were done on dilute gases, Bose gases and Fermi gases. But really, there were very few systems in which one could quantitatively see whether things worked out at all. So this led to people asking, what other systems are there where one could really check things out and do the theory? Because in the 50s, one didn't have the computing power available for solving real many-body problems like liquid helium. And there was a rather early paper by Hecht in 1959. And he remarked that if we look at the potential between two hydrogen atoms, then if the electrons are in a singlet state, then one expects to get molecular binding. So let me just say, I'll note the singlet by that. Whereas for the triplet state, we don't have all the chemical binding, so there's not a deep minimum here. All one has is a rather shallow minimum due to the van der Waals potential. And Hecht estimated that with the information he had about the potentials at that time, there would be no bound state of two hydrogen atoms in if they were polarized, because we didn't have this chemical binding. Because the difficulty with getting with most systems is that at low temperatures they'll form molecules, and so one won't be really exploring the effects that one wanted to look at. Now, nothing really happened as a result of this paper, and it was not until 1976 when there was an influential paper by Stwally and Nossina. This is a case of the National Science Foundation promoting interdisciplinary research, because at that time Stwally was on leave working at the chemistry division, and Nossinow was looking after part of the physics division. And while they were there, they wrote this paper, and they looked again at this question of what sort of systems one could make, where one could get dilute systems which were tractable theoretically. And using more modern data on the interactions, they came to the conclusion that the hydrogen, two spin-aligned hydrogen atoms would not form a bound state, and so would be a good candidate. And this led to a lot of experimental work on hydrogen, which eventually led to the successful Bose condensation of hydrogen in 1998 by Kleppner and Greytak and their colleagues at MIT. But this, however, was not the path that led to the first realization of a Bose condensate in these dilute systems. Because it turns out that hydrogen is an absolute bear to work with. There were lots of difficulties in cooling things. And in addition, hydrogen is very difficult to see because the spectral lines are all in the ultraviolet. And the important thing that had been happening sort of parallel with this development from the low temperature physics condensed matter community was from the 1975 onwards, was the development of methods using lasers to cool atoms. And in the beginning of the 1990s, one began to do experiments on alkali atoms. And this eventually led in 1995 to the observation of Bose-Einstein condensation in various alkali gases. Now, the technique that was used was, in fact, a mixture of this method developed by the atomic physics community, coupled with evaporative cooling. Which had really developed out of the hydrogen work, and it was by the marriage of these two techniques that one eventually managed to make the Bose condensate of hydrogen, or of the alkalis, in fact. And since that time, one has seen many other developments, like the cooling of fermions and of molecules and so on, but I won't go on say very much about those, because various other people will talk about those later. What I will do, maybe to finish off, my contribution is to just say a few things about characteristic parameters of these systems. Now, if one Jess asked, what are characteristic temperatures associated with these systems? So if we're thinking about bosons, then the characteristic temperature is just that for Bose condensation, or for, in the case of Fermi systems, it's the Fermi temperature, and they're in three dimensions just related to the densities of particles by the two-thirds power. And typically, these numbers are like one microkelvin. The densities we're talking about are typically of order 10 to the 12 to maybe up to 10 to the 15 particles per cubic centimeter. So a typical spacing between particles is of order, say, 10 to the minus 4 centimeters, 1 micron. So considerably more than in ordinary gases at room temperature. And because if we, and also it's small compared with liquid helium. So if we think about ordinary densities as well, 10 to the 22 or so, the densities are down by a factor of order 10 to the 10. So that gives you factors of order 10 to the 6 in the transition temperatures. And also for the atomic, for the atoms used, they're typically alkali. So this can be up to, say, 100. So that too reduces the temperature. And the nice thing about these systems is the fact that this energy is extremely low. So it means that it's possible to manipulate these systems either by magnetic fields, by having inhomogeneous magnetic fields just by the Zeeman effect, or by means of optical traps where one uses a laser beam, and through the Stark shift, that shifts the energy of the atom and so makes for traps. And one can make spatially non-uniform things by structures by making standing wave light beams, which will produce lattices and things of that sort, which we shall hear more about later. Now, a nice thing is that the interactions are important. One might have expected that at such low densities, interactions would not play a very important role. Condensed matter physicists have a tendency to put all dimensionless constants equal to one. But in this field, this can be dangerous because it turns out that the scattering length, which really characterizes all the interactions at low energies, is the only number you need, really. They're typically of order 10 to the 2 Bohr radii. And the reason for this, whereas one might argue from off the hat that atoms have sizes of order angstroms, and so scattering lengths you'd expect to be of the same size. What causes this difference is the fact that the potential at long distances, well, I drew it for hydrogen here, but out here one has the van der Waals potential. And to get a length out of the van der Waals potential, which in fact sets the scale of the scattering lengths, one can just think about the zero energy Schrodinger equation. So one has an energy h bar squared over twice the mass times some length that we're looking for, and then just equate that to the characteristic energy at that distance due to the van der Waals. So the van der Waals coefficient divided by L to the 6. So that gives us that the characteristic scale is of order the mass of an atom, and then to get it into atomic units, we want to divide by mass of an electron, and then this if we write the van der Waals coefficient in terms of the atomic unit of energy, E squared over A naught times something to get the dimensions straight, then the lengths turn out to be this. And this mass ratio between atoms and electrons gives me factors of 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 5. And the van der Waals coefficients for the alkalis are 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 4, basically because the alkalis are very polarizable. So this is where this number, why these atoms behave like enormous things with sizes much bigger than the size of the core. And that is very important in experiments, because it means that effects of interactions are in fact important, and it makes possible evaporative cooling.
Of course, it's obvious that the scattering is dominated by the long van der Waals scale as opposed to the hard core.
No, I'm cheating. This sets the scale for it, but in fact it can be both plus and minus, because this sets the scale, but there is an oscillatory factor that depends on, say, what you take for the core radius. And in fact, one can get any number between minus infinity and plus infinity, because there are many bounds. These potentials are very strong. These potentials are very strong in the sense there are very many bound states. And so the fact that people were looking for things that didn't make bound states was something of a red herring, because what's important is just that there's metastability, that the time to go to make molecules is rather long. This sets the scale. So if I solve a model problem in which there's a 1 over r to the 6 here and some short range things, then the general form will be a length of this size times an oscillatory function of involving the core radius. But this sets just I forget which one it is, whether it was a tangent or an arctangent.
Let me try to answer the question in a slightly different way. I think this is a generic scale in the sense that if you take a periodic table, you randomly select elements, then most of the scale like this, only when they are happen by accident and then hit the bound state. Or in other words, that if you take a potential, square root potential, just arbitrarily, just as a student to write down potential, but the most time you get the scale, which is microscopic scale, that's getting linked. Occasionally, some student may pick a value that would have divergences.
If you're sitting right, if there happens to be a resonance or a bound state just at zero energy, then of course you'll get infinity for the answer. But the chances of that happening if you just take random properties is small. So these atoms behave like absolutely enormous objects is the message to get out of this. And Jason will probably tell you about Feshbach. I now pass on to the other people, I guess, because. But let me just mention some of the other virtues of these things. There are many species of atoms that you can do experiments with, which makes for a very rich field. In addition, not only do you have different species, but you have different hyperfine states. You can couple the nuclear magnetic moments to the electronic spins in different ways, and in general the properties in the various states will be different. So there's enormous richness there. And another aspect which I won't have time to talk about is that you can make very different experiments from the sorts of things that one usually does in condensed matter physics, because of all the expertise that atomic physicists have developed. So you can in fact image not only particular species, but also the particular states that you're looking at, because the lines are at different frequencies, different enough so that the atomic physicists can tell the difference. And so without more ado, I think I should just turn over to the next member of the quartet, unless there are specific questions. Let's see.
Do I do have to use this? You plan on making a phone call? I would like to fast forward in time, and I would like to tell you the latest development, and probably I think the topic being pursued most intensely by different experimental group and by a large group of theorists today. It is the study of strongly interacting Fermi systems. It started with a very simple goal, which is just to cool a normal Fermi gas to its superfluid phase. And it is simple indeed, it's important, and experimentally it's very ambitious. It turns out it's very hard to cool fermions, and there's a lot of difficulties, and it requires great ingenuity to cool it. I'm not going to tell you the cooling mechanism, because now it's well-known, mostly developed by Debbie Jean, she has a sequence success. What I'm going to tell you now is the sequence of remarkable, truly remarkable developments last year in experiments. And when I'm going to tell you the great succession of discoveries, and I hope you can feel the competition, the intensity, and also the excitement. Sir? Let me just pursue a little bit, let me just say a few words about why the problem is difficult, and then I'm going to list the number of items I want to tell you. The reason it's difficult is something that you all know very well, especially from a condensed matter background. And then if you have a weakly interacting Fermi gas, and then the two species, let's say, and then the Tc is going to be of the order of Tf times now, I may remember there's a factor of two wrong, but the problem, the message is that usually in the particle spacing is like this, and then this, and then the scattering length is usually very small, as Chris has just mentioned, that if you just arbitrarily take an element, then it would be very much smaller than in the particle spacing. If you have attracted both gas, and then the Tc is going to be given by this small parameter, and then this is just too low, even for the co-atom experiments. And if you remember, the co-atom experiment can get to 10 to minus 9 degrees with great ease, but still, this would be very hard to achieve. However, it would be easily achieved if this is happening to be very large, and the largest can be is infinite. When it's infinite, then this is of the order of Tf, and it would be if you measure in the units of Tf, and it would be a super high temperature superfluid. And that was proposed by Mary Holland. And later on, there are a number of theoretical papers by Griffin, etc., that study these properties, the property of such a fluid. Now, So experimentally, what one wants to do is go to a regime where this is large. As usual, in
so in terms of the model that you wrote down, G, how is it related to AS?
Thank you very much. I have a formula there for gotten written down. So G is related to, it's very well studied. G is related to, we have read in this form, is related to the scattering length in this. So there's a very well, so apart from some constant, they are identical. And that is the low energy effective theory for a Fermi, for a fermion system. I often like to compare this with the, as often in any worthwhile physics endeavors, that on the way of achieving a goal, you discover that nature had many surprises for you, and that is in fact the case. Then, in the process of trying to achieve this quote unquote high temperature superfluid, and one discover many things, and that is the things that I want, and these are the items that I want to tell you, and it started in January last year, approximately, I think, 13 or 14 months ago.
Jason, I'm sorry, maybe I'm jumping ahead.
No, no, please. Yes.
In when superconductivity was studied, I mean, people said this strong coupled superconductors, right, using early algebra. And then they knew what happened when G went to infinity, roughly speaking. The temperature, transition temperature was like the square root of this coupling constant. Is this, does this thing have any relevance to atomic gases?
Some but not all. I mean, if I may, we can go into a little bit detail later. The scattering, the interaction vertex are quite different. But if you allow me, I have only 15 minutes. Since someone mentioned Wednesday, I would promise you I would have as little overlap as possible with today's discussion on Wednesday. Where am I? Oh, yes. Yes, that's right. So since in starting from January, then there are experiments. And the first one is to discover the what I call the universality in strongly interacting Fermi gases, and this is not the kind of universality that we encounter in critical phenomena. And I will explain to you what this universality is later. And then one then discover that this large G is closely related to molecules, and then their formation of, and then during the course of last year, and then quickly one can produce so-called molecular BEC, or molecular condensate. And then the final climax is about a couple months ago, there is an announcement in Jilla, and that they have discovered, they have fulfilled the promise, and they found the condensation of fermion pair. And it is, and the story itself that Barbara knows very well. And then if I have a little time, I will tell you the story later. And all happened within 1 year. Now, to describe this discovery to you efficiently, I would ask your permission to remind you a little bit about two-body problems. Many of you would know, but many of you, like me, when I first learned about it, might have forgotten. I would like to ask, to explain to you why, under what situation would this get big and what it really means. For the few theorists in the audience, I always tease my string theories, Kanji theorists colleagues. The question is that you take quantum electrodynamics, Tony. And then turn the fine structure constant to infinity, and then see what kind of theory that one would be getting. And that is, in fact, what we have. And then, in fact, the question is, I suppose I have a string theory. Whatever theory, you have a coupling constant, you turn it to infinity. What does that really mean? And that is what I think what this the atomic physicist, or the atomic physics experiment can contribute about the meaning of which. But let me quickly tell you what how to make this large. Let me first remind you that if I have a scattering potential, and then I have a scattering, and then the phase shifts, and then the wave function undergo a phase shift, it looks something like this. And then now, in order to put, because of phase shifts, the wave function, the waves are changed, have changed, so the energy is shifted. And the now, so let's look at how the energy of the system is changed. So the best way is to compare it with the case where you have no potential. So there's no interaction. Then what would happen is that you set a boundary condition, and then immediately, then you can write down. Then if I write, you can write down the energies. The energy is just k squared over 2m, but k is given by pi over r times an integer. So the lowest one would be h bar squared or pi over r squared. Now, of course, it's going to shrink down to zero when the box is large. And the next one
is going to be, you put 2 here, and so on and so forth, and then another one up there. As we turn on the, suppose now I'm going to turn on the interaction. Suppose here I have a potential, which is nothing, which is U. Suppose the potential I'm interested in is this one with a depth of U naught, and this is U naught equals 0. And this, but as I put it down, and then the, is it attractive? So this guy is going to come down, and the general behavior is like so. And this, so the energy level evolve into, so from one side to the other side, but then there's a bound state peel off from continuum if the potential is negative enough. And if one work out the so-called S wave scattering thing, and then with, again, this is the critical potential, and then one would discover that watch this energy level. Now this is negative. And you can convince yourself, just looking at the asymptotic formula for the phase shifts, and the energy is coming down. And this is a negative scattering thing, so the energy goes negative. And remember that the negative scattering has no bound states. But then this is a positive scattering thing. It's the other way around. It has a bound state sitting right down there. So the scattering length is actually a measurement of energy from the continuum state and has nothing to do with bound state. And that's why one would have this weird situation when the system looks as if it is repulsive and yet it has a bound state. So that is but that is all you need to understand about how the interaction and how the scattering length goes to infinity. Now, so this is this region where it's getting big. And in particular, you can measure it with respect to the in particle spacing. And this, if it's greater than 1, then this refers to the strongly interacting region. And outside, way out here, is weakly interacting. And then way out here, then you have molecules. The ground state is really molecules. And out here, then you have scattering states with attractive interactions. If you want to have a repulsive Bose gas, a weakly interacting repulsive Bose gas, what you need to do is that you pick a sample over here, get rid of it at high temperature, and get rid of this state, because high temperature, this state is not occupied, and then you cool it down. Now, once you cool it down, it's still very hard to access this state, because you cannot get S0 plus 0 equals to minus 1 or minus 10, for example, because this way it runs way down there. So once you prepare a system over here, 2 particle collisions cannot get you down. So if you, I start from here and then try to push the system across, then you can get molecules. And that is, in fact, what is seen in some of the experiments. With this background, now I'm going to tell you the whole sequence of experiments. You can probably understand it very quickly without any problem. Just to make sure I do not lose any audience, and also I know that my time is short, I would take maybe 30 seconds, invite some questions and answer questions. So now let me tell you the experiments. In the first, so the experiment can be illustrated by, let's say, the phase diagram. I should say a few words about what is fresh about resonance. I have told you what resonance are. This is the, which is that this, I'm just dealing with a potential of this shape, some potential, some attractive part, I just pull it down. And then the model for this is still this guy with the up and down spins with the interaction given by this shape. And this set of model in the current jargon is called the single channel model. Why it's a single channel, we don't need to worry at the moment. There is other schemes that, which is what we happen in these systems, that generate these scattering lengths. It turns out what happened is that when in this atomic gas, which has a, turns out they can prepare two particular spin states, and there are 2 kinds of channels. Again, if you don't know the jargon, it's not important. Channel just means a set of quantum numbers. You fix a set of quantum numbers. And then suppose this 2 spins 7 halves, 7
minus 7 half, for example, and they scatter. And so this is, they have experience, if they experience potential, but then you can prepare them in a scattering state, so there's just a guess. However, if you change the quantum number, maybe 7 half, 5 half, let's say, and then this two sets of object has a bound state. And this state has a different magnetic moment from this state. So by applying a magnetic field, you can shift things up and down. And therefore, this bound, this level can cross this bound state. And when it crosses, there will be a lot of multiple scattering. And that is that multiple scattering that generates a lot of, they generate a very large effective scattering length. And the model of this is simply like this. Have two species of fermions, and then but then I would have a bound state molecules with two times of mass, and then there would be a relative energy change which you can tune by the magnetic field, and then there is a coupling between this guy, and then turn it back and forth, and then there's some residual interaction, not important. These are main pieces, and so this model says that if I change this energy scale, and then I can get to a very large scattering. And it also says that if I change this below, well, if this below the continuum, then I would have real molecules. But in here, then I would have a quasi-bound state which would decay through the interaction between them, which is hyperfine interactions. So the experiment is done in this phase diagram where this is the magnetic field where the two levels cross. So on this side, then you will have real molecules. And on this side, you have free fermions. And in particular, with the negative scattering length on this side. In this case, if you only look at the continuum, you have a positive scattering length. And now I can tell you quickly the so-called discovery. Around January last year, and also in March, there are two groups, they measure the energy in the systems. And they discovered that if you measure the energy here and there, and then just look at the internal energy, I don't have time to tell you how you measure it, but what they find is that the internal energy is universal in the following sense. The interaction energy, equals to the Fermi energy plus some interaction energy for weakly interacting Fermi gas will be G times N. Remember that I have done something like this, just G times N squared and then N down. So, however, this formula doesn't make sense when G goes to infinity. And what happened is that what is found is that this is equal to beta. The interaction energy is exactly given by the same formula, the Fermi energy, basically saying that when G goes to infinity, there's no length scale apart from the density scale, and there's only one energy you can construct, which is En. And beta is equals to minus 0.3 in the beginning, but now later experiment shows minus 0.5. And so we need to be settled. So that is what is found experimentally. And this is not just one measurement. And this measurement allows one to fit many data. So this is, I think, pretty well established. And then at that time, Lawson realized that this beta itself is connected to, it's negative, it's connected to the bound states of the systems. So both Duke and ENS has discover this fact. And then around May, and Debbie Jean was able to produce a lot of molecules. Once he told people how to make the molecules, the idea is very simple. You just take this here and just move the whole thing across here. As simple as it is, but somehow escape a lot of experimentalists. And then once she has a lot of molecules, and everybody trying to condense this object. And then it's around May. And then in November, there are three different groups. They found molecular condensates around here. And the MI, is the Innsbruck, the first one. And then the Gila, and then MIT.
Now, remember, however, that the goal is to find out whether you can produce a Fermi fluid, i.e. on this side, I want to condense this whole thing. This is a molecular side, which one we know that it's good to have a molecular condensate, but it's something that we have seen before. But here, so the question is, what happened around here? This expectation has been through an ancient Markel old theory of Engels, Naget, and Schmidt-Schmidtwin, is that the system would gradually cross over from a BCS superfluid to a BEC, and the expectation is that the TC is very high on this side, given, and then could gradually become very small. And so now you have to superpose this with that. So the question is that at that time, as of November, whether any of these experiments is already in a superfluid phase or not, or whether this theory is completely wrong. So now I lead this to the latest experiments, and which will be discussed a lot in our conference. Again, Gabby Jean have done the following experiments. You have to listen a little bit carefully to understand why it's so remarkable. So she does something like this, start from some place here, which is, I don't know what it is, they want to find out what it is, very close to resonance. And then suddenly he jump over here, very fast. Now this side, one knows that there's a molecule, the molecular condensate, there's a lot of things here. Now, however, by putting the system so fast over here, then the hope is that, well, suppose here I have big pairs like this, and here I have some pairs like this. Maybe there's some overlap, and I can detect what happened here. Now, what is found is something like this, that if this is close to resonance, then one get a peak. This is normal stuff, and this is the condensate. One get a molecular condensate come out, and then there's a chunk of them is condensate. There's a chunk of them is an excitation, and they can measure this. If they do it over here, they see the same thing. Over here, they see the same thing. If they move slightly over here, they don't see anything. So there is a boundary. And in other words, that and then this is the excitation, so it's normal. And then you get something deep, and then there's a boundary, not like this. And that is the current finding, and at the moment, there are a lot of discussions and what this really means and what one has found, and I don't think I have time to talk about it, but I think there will be a lot of discussions in the conference and on this subject, and I have also, if I may, recently put out a paper on this. So I think I can.
Yeah. You know, the ways they can directly measure the superfluid density, perhaps by putting on a periodic optical lattice sliding in it, or something like that. I mean, to because you.
This is okay. Let me just tell you a joke. one day, it's very, very relevant to ask to this conference. But one day I asked, maybe it's about a year ago, I asked Eric Cornelius, Eric, can you do flashback resonance in rotating gases? And they wrote back, said, Jason, rotating experiments are hard. Fresh resonance are hard. So, but then later I tell him that, look, we don't want to hear this because the BEC experiments are hard. So now, I think what you said is correct, is true. They can do it, they haven't gotten around to do it. No, it can be done. It will be done. I mean, but yeah, it hasn't been done.
Another comment to Matthew is that one of the interesting differences between superfluid helium and this stuff is that for the helium, it's easy to measure the superfluid properties, but it's very hard to measure the condensates. As took years and years of work with the
all the neutron scattering and other kinds of things. And of course, here you can't make leads, so it's hard to measure the superfluid properties, but it's actually pretty easy to measure the condensate, because you just turn off the trap and study how it expands. And so it's kind of a converse. It's a little more like asking, how do you prove that a nucleus is superfluid? Again, because there they have to use these systematics of even and odd neutron pairing, which is sort of convincing, but it's a little strange.
But I mean, have people just taken the optical ladders and slid them?
Yes, and in fact,
whether they drag along. The
yes, and you if you drag if you push it a little bit, it sloshes, and if you push it too hard and too fast, all hell breaks loose. Mark Kasevich has been working on that, and a lot of other people. I don't know whether Mark's going to talk about that. He's coming here for the conference, but it's...
Mark promised to report something remarkable.
Well, I mean, they're very interesting. It's just, and it's presumably associated with the destruction of superfluidity with a critical velocity. When you get moving fast enough, you start getting radiation. And so it's like Cherenkov radiation, sort of. And so, again, all hell breaks loose. But it's much more complicated. In these, in the lattices, Stringari's done a lot of work on that. I just wanted to say a little bit about rotation, and there are two things that I want to talk about. First of all, the sort of moderate rotation limit, where how you can see how the rotation comes in and what its effect is, and then what happens when you start to rotate really fast. So let me just write down what's an effective energy or how energy functional in a rotating frame. And let me deal with a two-dimensional system, because if you rotate fast enough, they become very flat and very pancake-shaped. So you just get a kinetic energy, psi star del squared over 2m psi plus a trap energy, 1/2 m omega perp squared r squared. This is the harmonic trap. You get a 1/2 g psi to the fourth, and then there's a psi squared here. And then you get the rotation comes in because you get transformation to a rotating frame, psi star omega dot r cross p psi. This is just omega dot the angular momentum. This is the transformation of the rotating frame. Now, if you're not rotating too fast, you can be in what's called the Thomas-Fermi limit, when g times the central density, which is essentially the chemical potential, is much bigger than the oscillator energy, h bar omega perp. This is the condition that the wave function is relatively smoothly varying. You can ignore a lot of vortex cores, and so you can average over this, and you get a vortex lattice with small core. So what you end up with is a density that looks like this, with a lot of very tiny microscopic holes drilled in it. And on the average, the velocity field adds up to be approximately omega cross r. In that case, this term will just become the density times 1/2 mv squared. This term is just the trap energy times the density. This I'm going to skip for the moment, and this becomes minus the density times just mv squared, or if you like, you can write this m v squared is m omega squared r squared. And the magic is that this term and this term, you get a factor of 1/2, you get a factor of minus 1. And when you combine these two together, what you end up is you get minus 1/2 m omega squared r squared times the density. And so these two terms together give you a new effective trap frequency that omega perp squared goes into omega perp squared minus omega squared. And it's clear that as this gets close to this value, the thing becomes unbound. It's like trying to put a particle on a spring and rotate it. And if you rotate faster than the trap frequency, the spring frequency, the centrifugal forces will pull it off to infinity. And so all hell breaks loose when this approaches this value, the trap frequency. And that's why this gets so interesting. Now, you can check that the chemical potential, which is essentially this interaction energy, decreases like the square root of 1 minus omega squared over the trap frequency squared. So eventually, the interaction energy will decrease and get comparable to this. And that's when you cease to be in this Thomas Fermi limit, and you go over to what people believe is now these strongly correlated systems. It also turns out, when you check these out, that the radius of the condensate as a function of rotation in the two-dimensional limit goes like 1 minus omega squared over the trap frequency squared. And you get a small fraction, but this will eventually diverge. And so it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And because of the conservation of particles, again, you can see that the central density and the energy, the effective interaction energy becomes comparable. And so in that case, you actually have to rewrite this in a different form, and you no longer can use any of these Thomas Fermi approximations. And this was work that Jason did a couple of years ago, and he suggested that when the rotation frequency approaches the trap frequency, then it's convenient to rewrite this energy in another form, where you take out omega perp minus omega times LZ, and this is going to be small in this limit, and then you get an integral d2r, which looks, let me just write the kinetic energy, you get psi star h bar over 2m, and you get minus I times the gradient minus omega perp cross r times squared times psi. Now, this piece looks like p minus ea over c, and so you can think of this as a particle that now, instead of being in a rotating field with a trap frequency, you can think of this as being an equivalent magnetic field where A is omega perp Z cross R. And the curl of this is just a constant, so this is an effective uniform magnetic field. And so that if this gets to be sufficiently close, if this is sufficiently small, you pass over into regime which looks like a two-dimensional particle in an effective magnetic field, and that's where you get this quantum Hall physics. And experimentally, people have got to the regime where this parameter is comparable to this. And that takes an enormous amount of effort. Eric Cornell has gotten the closest, but he's really been pushing things. And if you can get G n naught much less than h bar omega perp, then you should be in the regime which is called the lowest Landau level regime, and you should be able to study these effects in great detail. Now, typically that means that omega over omega perp is currently the order of 0.99, I don't know, 0.993, 994. Five. This is the best that Eric Cornell and his group have been able to do. You have to really think of it almost like talking about metallic purity. You need four nines, three nines, four nines, or you need a logarithmic scale in order to make sense of this. But this has been a couple of years of very hard work on Eric's part, Eric and his group, and they don't seem to be able to do a lot better in any simple way. And nobody quite knows what the problems are. So those are one of the interesting sets of questions that people have been talking about. I mean, lots of interesting questions come to mind. Can we reach the correlated limit? What's the best way to get there? If you imagine taking this big condensate like this and then breaking it up into lots of little pieces, either horizontally or vertically with an optical lattice, you then have systems where the total number is much smaller. Roughly speaking, in the correlated limit, the angular momentum representing the number of vortices over the number of particles has to be of order bigger than 1. And one way to do this is to try to break these up so the number of particles is small. Is that going to be an effective way? Nobody knows. Are there obvious signatures that you're actually in the correlated state as opposed to these Thomas-Fermi states? And again, we don't really know. Let me just mention one other thing, one other trick that people have tried to use. And this is what's done at the École Normale Supérieure by Dalibar's group. If instead of just dealing with this r to the squared potential, you add a 1/2 lambda r to the fourth potential, this will give you confinement, even if you rotate, even if omega is bigger than the trap frequency. And Dalibar's group has been able to get omega over omega perp, the order 1.05, at which point all hell breaks loose. The condensate seems to lose its stability. The vortex lattice seems to disappear. Nobody has a clue what's going on. Is this a fundamental limit? Is it an experimental limit? Their condensates are long and thin, so is this a three-dimensional effect? Is it a three-dimensional instability? Nobody knows. But these are very interesting questions. And of course, the last question, one way of studying the superfluidity of a Fermi system is to ask, do you form vortices? What happens if you rotate a Fermi system very fast? Obviously nobody's done that. They've had to work very hard to get to the Fermi systems at all, but that's clearly one of the interesting possibilities. So we expect there's going to be a lot of intense discussions on all these questions during this conference, and in fact during the whole workshop. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, we can move on. Okay?
How come the number of vortices can be larger than the number of particles?
In principle, you can add more and more angular momentum. It's just, I mean, Mike Gunn and Nicola have worked on that using trial wave functions for or exact solutions for small number. If you have 8 particles or 10 particles, people have done a lot of numerical work, and you can study states with very large angular momentum. Or there, you study these also these things called IRAST states.
The boundary seems to be probably more a bit like a tenth.
Okay.
Where
instead of one. But it's at least, I mean, the typical, these experiments, the best that I think Eric Cornell has been able to do is probably this is like n over n, the number, this is like 1 in 100, right? 1% rather than 0.1 or 1. So the angular momentum in the vortices, the number of vortices is much smaller than the number of atoms.
It's not the number of vortex cores.
It's the angular momentum. Okay. Jory, do you want to say a little?
So what do I do?
Put this in your pocket.
Okay.
And I'll put this on you.
Yes. Oh, thank you, Jason. Okay. Does everybody hear me? Yes? Good. Actually, what we decided to do before giving this presentation is that Chris gives a general introduction, and then we three remaining co-directors just enlight more or less hot topics of the field, which are now. And Jason told about fermions, and Sandy told about rapidly rotating systems. And what is left for me are low-dimensional systems, 1D and 2D systems. So this sounds a little bit strange for people who are not involved in the field of quantum gases, because all gases that we obtain nowadays are three-dimensional. So, but what happens is the following. Let me imagine that I have a harmonic trap in one direction, and I tightly confine the system. I confine the gas to zero-point oscillations. And this is the amplitude of zero-point oscillations, which is h-bar divided by the particle mass trap frequency in the power 1/2. Yes, omega zero. So then, and in this direction, the gas is, let's say, free. So then, what we see is that kinematically and statistically, the system becomes one-dimensional. yes? Because this, the motion in two directions, in two radial directions, is frozen. So, yes. So this is like that. In these two directions, the motion is frozen to 0 point oscillations. Okay, in this direction, the motion is free. So I get kinematically and statistically one-dimensional systems. And in a sim, of course, what I have to assume in this case, that this L0, this confinement length, is much smaller than the characteristic correlation length in this direction. Yes, then the system is really 1D. And the only difference from a purely 1D system is that I have to know what is the interaction constant in the system. Because when particles approach each other to a distance smaller than this L0, they interact like in three dimensions. Because this L0 can be done several hundred angstroms, let's say 1,500, 300, something like that. Therefore, when particles collide, they are three-dimensional. But long-range correlations, well, even medium-range or some short-range correlations of the order of L0 and larger are one-dimensional, yes? So we get this system. In a similar way, we get two-dimensional systems within my drawing facilities. It's like that, yes, under the same conditions. Here we freeze one direction of motion to zero-point oscillations. So, you, of course, you may ask me, so what? The 1D and 2D systems have been under investigation for a very long time, and it's nice that now people obtain these systems in experiments. So what you should do, you should go to a library, take books written by famous people, read these books, maybe in the 1D case, learn what is the Luttinger approach, and then tell us, interpret experiments, this is it, yes? Of course, statement number one is that, first of all, this is the first realization of one-dimensional and two-dimensional gases in nature, yes? And, for example, how it has been done, simply trapped condensate, which is originally three-dimensional, was confined to 1D or to 2D. And this is done in 1D for MIT, ENS, MIT Ketterle, ENS Christoph Salomon, and Munich. This is the lab of Ted Hensch, Emanuel Bloch. And in 2D, again, Ketterle and Florence. Yes? So, and these are rubidium and sodium condensates.
Innsbruck.
Yes. Innsbruck. You're absolutely right. Who said that? Who said Innsbruck? You, okay. Yes, you know. Yes, sorry. Okay. You didn't say that? Okay, you should have done so. And then, you know, so what is the situation then? What do we do? Of course, in the 2D case, the situation, if I just take uniform 2D gas, the situation is more or less known. We know that at finite temperature there is no long-range order, that there is a quasi-condensate, and so on. At zero temperature, we have true condensate, period. But then, what is interesting now with these 2D systems are two things. First, they are in an external field, because in this direction, this direction is actually not free, it's a shallow confined direction. And then, interesting question, just to tell you why we are studying this system. So we have two-dimensional gas in a trap, so 2D trap, yes? The question looks trivial. What is the nature of the phase transition to the Bose-Condensed state in the 2D interacting trapped gas? Just very simple. But very simple question. In the uniform case, we know that this is Kosterlitz-Tauless transition for the interacting gas, and that's it. But then, if I consider an ideal gas in a harmonic trap, yes, ideal gas in a harmonic two-dimensional trap, then it has been found already more than 10 years ago that in the 2D, the gas undergoes ordinary Bose-Einstein condensation due to a change of the density of states compared to the uniform case. The 2D trapped gas is equivalent to the four-dimensional uniform gas with regard to density of states. Therefore, here we have ordinary Bose-Einstein condensation. Okay, what is the phase what is the nature of the phase transition in the 2D trapped gas? Just very simple question. And then the other thing with 2D is what happens with rapidly rotating 2D gases, and that's what Sandy was discussing. And already now, in experiments of Eric Cornell at GILA, due to a rapid rotation of the system where the gas expands very strongly, they have 2D system or quasi 2D system. Yes, so this is. This is, for example, this. Then 1D. In the one-dimensional case, we are extremely happy that for short-range interacting particles, we can write the Hamiltonian in the first quantization as minus h squared divided by 2m Laplacian, d2 dxi, where index I numerates particles, plus 1 half g sum over I not equal to j delta function of xi minus xj. Okay, so this is for short-range interacting particles. We reduce our problem to the presence of the coupling constant with the delta functional interaction. And everybody knows that this is nothing else than the well-known Lieb-Linegar model. Yes. Although Lieb-Linegar model is already known for 40 years, the calculation of correlation functions, for example, single particle correlation function, one body density matrix, I just combining two terms for the atomic physics and condensed matter community, is a big deal. You open the book of Karepin, famous book, where a lot of things using the inverse scattering method and so on are presented. And then you really see that in order to obtain the answer for something, you have to do a lot of work yourself. This is first. Second, I didn't say anything bad about Karepin. This is a very nice book. This is a very nice book. Very nice book. We were even able to extract one very useful expression for the Lieb-Linegar wave function from this book. You know, very nice book. And then what I'm going to say is the following. Experimentally, what has been done so far is that Bose-Einstein condensate was confined to 1D. In the 1D case, we know that we can exactly describe also the strongly interacting regime, or the so-called Tong-Girardot regime, where the wave function of particles is strongly decreasing when particles approach each other. So whether we are in the weakly interacting regime or in the strongly interacting regime, it is determined by the well-known parameter gamma, which is the ratio of the kinetic energy, the ratio of the interaction energy divided by the kinetic energy at mean interparticle separation. And this turns out to be mass of the particle, g divided by h squared density. So in the present stage, people have achieved both the Einstein condensates or quasi-condensates in 1D, where BC gamma much smaller than 1. This has been done already a few years ago. And recently, at NIST and ETH in Zurich, people achieved gamma of the order of 1. And it's now really a big challenge to achieve gamma much larger than 1. And there is a serious problem. We have to study the kinetics of particles in the one-dimensional case. Because, you know, in 1D, if I use a single particle picture, then two particles collide in 1D. They either exchange their momenta or the momenta do not change. In order to get serious kinetics, then I have to include many body effects. Yes? And therefore, for large gamma, this kinetics is seriously slowed down, strongly slowed down, which is one of the difficulties on achieving this strongly interacting regime. Tong-Girardot, we call it Tong-Girardot, is gamma much larger than 1. It's now a big challenge for experiments. And you know, I can tell a very interesting story. So, what people can do? Look here, I would like to achieve gamma much larger than 1. What do I do? Let me decrease density. But you know, in one-dimensional guesses, which people create now, the density is small, and then if I significantly decrease density, I am left with a few particles. It's just not good. Then, the coupling constant. Try to use Feshbach resonances, include this coupling constant, and so on, or try to increase this confinement, make this length smaller, then this is effective one-dimensional coupling constant, then it goes up. It turns out to be extremely difficult, at least a few years of experimental work, because the confinement which we have now is 30 kilohertz here. It's big anyway. So, and for example, for rubidium, the Feshbach resonances are very difficult, almost do not exist. They exist, but it's very difficult to use them. So what do? And Planck constant I cannot change, sorry. So what do? Let me change the mass of a particle. How? Put a shallow lattice in this long direction, then particles undergo tunneling, and their effective mass increases, yes? And then this automatically leads to an increase of this parameter. And in this way, Emmanuel Bloch reached in his experiments the Tonks-Girardot limit with gamma 100 or gamma 200 for rubidium 87 atoms in an optical lattice. So now why I just mentioned that? It's a remarkable experiment, and Emmanuel will be here. He will tell you how this is done and detected. That we actually have two types of systems. We have the system gaseous phase, and we have a system of one-dimensional or two-dimensional optical lattice. Yes, optical lattice is the following. It's very simple. I have two counter-propagating laser beams, which make me the standing wave. And then in the minimum of the optical potential, atoms are sitting. Yes, so it's a standing wave of light, and here atoms are sitting. So in 1D or in 2D or in 3D, it's a typical Bose-Hubbard model for bosons or Fermi-Hubbard model for fermions, no problem. So what are great challenges now? So you can tell me, your behavior in the harmonic potential is nice, but it doesn't bring something fundamental. There are interesting things, and the phase diagram changes, you get finite size effects, and so on. And people are now investigating these things. So what people from condensed metaphysics usually say, and they're absolutely right, that long wave properties are generic, yes? You just take the Luttinger model, and this is it. And this is absolutely correct. Although the numerical coefficients for the Luttinger model should be taken from the exact solution. But what is interesting is the following, that in the gas phase and also in the lattice phase with Bose-Hubbard model, we are very often interested in short-range correlations. For example, if I take atoms in a lattice, yes, and want to arrange a system with strong quantum entanglement between the atoms towards quantum computation, I have to know short-range correlations between particles. So, and the short-range correlations between particles, they do not follow from the Luttinger model. We have to present the exact solution. Therefore, what it says nowadays that one should really think on developing exactly solvable models. So one of the examples of this model is, of course, the Lieb-Linegar model, yes, which is exactly solvable in many cases. For example, single component Bose gas in the gas phase, a two-component Fermi gas, Fermi-Hubbard model, two-component Bose gas with three equal interaction constants, and so on. And then, you know, and this is really very important to understand. So one of the interesting things, just to give you a detail here, which can be a detail and can be a fundamental thing. Let us take a spinor Bose gas. What it means is Bose gas with atoms in two internal states. So these are actually spin 1/2 bosons, right? Then what we know from C. N. Yang from 1967, if to read carefully his paper, that this model, that if the three interaction constants are equal to each other, this is the exactly solvable model by the Bertrand's. So what I can do, I can write down the exact expression for the wave function, and then I can work on it and find some correlations and so on, although this is very difficult. So then, what is interesting in this system is that it is characterized by an additional quantum number, isotopic spin, which ranges from half the number of particles in the system to zero. The ground state is usually the ferromagnetic state where the isotopic spin is equal to the total number of particles. Yes, and then, but the excited states in the space of the isotopic spin are quite different from the ground state. For example, the states with an isotopic spin close to zero are a la antiferromagnetic, and they're characterized by a high degree of quantum entanglement. Therefore, what one should do for such a system, if one wants to know short-range correlations and investigate possibilities for quantum entanglement of the atoms, one has to present an exactly solvable model, solve it, and find short-range correlations for a given value of the isotopic spin. Yes, and in the gas phase, it can be done, because in the gas phase, this model is exactly solvable, but I didn't mention that in the lattice, the Bose-Hubbard is not. And what is most interesting for the quantum entanglement, towards quantum computation, is the lattice case, because in the lattice case, you can easily manipulate the atoms, making qubits. Yes, and you can do it individually with light. Peter Zoller knows it much better than I do. He can say a few words about quantum computation later. Yes, I'm not an expert here. But what do we see? That we also...
You should probably be thinking of going to a close, I guess.
Sorry?
It's after 1:30.
Yes, but I'm talking 15 minutes. No? More? Okay. So what I'm just saying here is that one should really think on developing methods of finding short-range correlations in lattice systems with bosons and so on. And I'm just emphasizing that developing exactly solvable models for the lattice system and gas phase, it's a lot of meat for theorists for these new systems, which are now under investigation also experimentally. Thank you for attention.